Good evening, friends. My name is Harry and I'm an alcoholic. It's a pleasure being here. I'm going to say that anyway, whether it is or not. But it's nice to be among all you people. Before we come over tonight, I'm talking to my little sponsee, and she's speaking up in Glasgow at this time and moment. Linda and I told her at the, we'd say a little prayer for her while she's speaking over there, and she said a little prayer for us while we're here. So that's how it works in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was born and bred in Scotland, a little place called Renton, R-E-N-T-O-N, 17 miles from Glasgow, and 3 miles from Loch Lomond. I was brought up in a time when everything was really bad. Before my 14th birthday, I got a job out of school, and I started work up there, you know. And my father and mother never had much problems with drink. We were too busy trying to make money to keep 6 of us alive, you know. And poverty stricken all over the place. He was a good poacher. He worked in the shipyard, but he heard people talking about poaching salmon and trout, potatoes, turnips, you name it. My dad taught us all these things, you know. We're thieving, you know, that's what they call it religiously. But the name of the game was poaching. And that's how we lived for years and years. I was in the early 30s. I know I'm kind of young looking for that, but it was nearly 30s when I was born. I left school, like I said, and my dad taught us all to box. He had a boxing ring out the backyard. Four boys and one girl. And my sister could beat all of us. Knock the hell out of all of us. And that came in handy in later years, you know. Like I said, I left school when I was 14 years of age. Started work. And my first wages, you got in a little package, you know. And my mother was the only woman ever to get my wages without me opening them up to see what's in it. Because while I was in that factory, we were taught how to thieve. They made silks for all the foreign countries, suit lengths, and drapes, and all these things. We learned how to steal them. That was preps of the job, you know. And my mother never had to worry about giving me any money back for looking after myself. And at that time I was training 3 times a week to do the boxing and playing soccer on a Saturday and a Sunday. Everything was going good. And the king, just before he died at that particular time, decided he needed some troops in his army. And he called me up to go to England to the army. I think it was 1950 by then. And I went to a place called Devizes down in England. And this is where my education, my vocabulary changes a wee bit, you know. Because I never liked English people. You know, that was just the way I was brought up. Anyway, I went down to England anyway to start my 2 years, 18 months it was, in the British Army. And the big sergeant that welcomed us into the barracks, and he says, "Can any of you guys make a bed?" And they were all standing there with their tongues hanging out. And I said, "I'll make the bed." And he made the bed and he pulled it apart. He had a big stick under his arm. He pulled it apart. Made it again. And pulled it apart again. And I was getting a little bit perturbed by this time. I started to make the bed again anyway. And he says, "You know, the king wouldn't like that and I don't like it." And I told him what I thought about him and the king. And I put the head on him, jumped up him, just butted him. And I finished up in the jail, the army. And that was where I started my career in the British Army. Again, the boxing team, and doing well, you know. And I met my first love in the army. And she liked to drink. I had a drink occasionally at that particular time, you know. Boxing came first, soccer came second, my family came third, and the girlfriend at that particular time came last. And on the fairgrounds in Scotland, England, Ireland and Wales, there's a boxing booth with a bulk. A boxing booth, they called it. And the guys would stand out with the gloves and throw them to somebody that wanted to make a few dollars more. And you'd go in there for three or four rounds, see how long you lasted. It was a pound a round, I guess, at a particular time. And I always got the gloves when they came out. And usually I made about £3 a night. That'd be about $9 by that time, in the 1950s. And if I had met this girl, and we'd go and she'd like a drink, and I'd take a little drink with her. And I didn't like drink. It changed me completely, you know. But I came out of the British Army in 1952. My younger brother was coming over to America to visit my sister. She was in service over here. And he got married instead. So I came in his place to Philadelphia. I left Scotland the 13th of March 1954, and I landed here on the 17th of March. And we're all drinking green beer up in New York when I landed. Come over to Queen Elizabeth, and I believe that's when this alcoholic was born, and board that ship, because I was in everybody's bed but my own on board that ship. And they told me I get barred out of every bar. There must be 20 bars on board that ship, and I was barred out of every one of them. And I landed in New York anyway, and I had all sorts of gifts for relatives all over the country. They'd all emigrated here years and years and years ago, and I had a card boot sale on the deck that night. Sold everything that we had in the case, my luggage. I landed there with very, very little. And my sister picked us up in New York, took us down to Philadelphia, and that's when the trouble started. I landed there, and like I said, the 17th of March, 1954. And from there on in, right up to, I left in 1970 to come home to bury my dad. The things that happened in between there was a nightmare. And to grant you all these things, to tell you the truth that I'm dual addicted. Alcohol and wedding cake was my addiction. I met a guy when I came out of, I got in the American Army anyway. I get caught up in a place called Newport, Rhode Island. And the guys that picked me up, I thought they were a couple of Mormons, but they didn't. Mormons don't carry guns, you know what I mean? And these guys asked me my name, when did I come to America? And I told them all the story, you know, and says, you better come with us then, you're dodging the draft. I said, dodging the what? You're dodging the draft. I didn't know nothing about a draft. They gave me an alien card. Not, I mean, one of these aliens up there, one from Scotland. And they took me to a place called Providence, Rhode Island. And upstairs in the courtroom, they had a recess at lunchtime, and it was in the City Hall or wherever it was. I went downstairs to have a look around, and I'd seen all these recruiting stations down the stairs, and there were only one open, and it was the 82nd Airborne Division. And I walked in there and signed up for 3 years. And I came out of there and went back up the stairs to see the judge, and he asked me if I had anything to say before he passed sentence, and I told him I belonged to Uncle Sam, and he said, could you explain that please? And he says, well, the guy down there just gave me a flying 20. He says, and I belong to Uncle Sam. I'm in the army. So he gave the FBI agents two of the belt and sent me down to see the recruiting sergeant. The recruiting sergeant put me in charge of the bus to go to Fort Dix, New Jersey. And I put around the seven tradition basket, as you usually do, you know, and got 10 gallons of Manischewitz wine. for the trip over the river. And the bus going over one of the bridges. I used to say it was the Brooklyn Bridge. It could have been the bridge over the river. Why, I didn't know the difference between the bridges. But it was a bridge from New York into New Jersey. And the cops pulled us over, and everybody on the bus got arrested, including me and the driver. The guy, cop, drove the bus into Fort Dix, New Jersey. Everybody came fighting the barracks. And that was the start of my career in the British, in the American Army. It was the Salvation Army, the British Army, and now I'm in the American Army. And there was some hope, you know. Things happened in the... I got transferred down to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to learn to jump out of aeroplanes. And anybody who's been down Fort Bragg, I'm not kidding you, they told me it was 90 in the shade, and there were no shade down there. And every time you would come out of the camp, you put everything you had on your back, and you sang while you were running. Craziest army I've ever been in my life. Anyway, they got me to jump out of the aeroplane, and I'm still looking for Geronimo. Every time you come out of there, somebody shouts Geronimo. I'm still looking for a guy, you know. I got 5 jumps in, and this guy shows up to give us all our wings, pinball wings. He comes out of this car anyway, a Jeep, and he's a big white Stetson hat, 2 pill-handed revolvers, and his cowboy boots. And he's coming down the wing, and he's pinning all of his wings on people. And he got to me, and I bust out laughing. And he says, "What's the matter with you, soldier?" I says, "I thought you were Roy Roy just coming down there, you know." And subordination, so I get put in the jail again. All of us started off rightly, you know, in these places. But 3 or 4 weeks after that, a guy got up with me and he told me he was starting the boxing team up. And I get into the boxing team. And that was the end of my soldiering for a while. But I'd jump every now and again for a pay jump, and that was about the size of it. I get in the boxing team and I won the 3rd Army Championship, the All-Army Championship, and then the Service Championship. That was 1956 or 57. I won the Fort Bragg Championship 3 years in a row. And all I had to do was wake up in the morning, do some road work, get into the gym. It was magic. Really good. I went to walkabouts for a while. A big Indian eye. I never met an Indian in America as a chief. This big chief and I went and walkabouts up into Canada for about 3 weeks. AWOL. And I went back to Fort Bragg and I handed myself into the... And I met a guy. He was in jail at the camp-based guardhouse. And I was asking him how he's getting out on with his dues and things like that. He says, "I'm getting a leave of absence." I said, "How did you manage that?" He was supposed to be going to jail with me. He says, "Well, I get my appendix out." I says, "What happened?" He says, "I told him I've got a pain here and a pain there," and they took me in and operated on my appendix out, and they gave me a leave. I says, "That's a good idea, you know." So we're running up to the camp with this 2 prison guards with me. I collapsed on the grass and I did the same thing as that guy did. I told him I've got a pain here and a pain there. They took me in, and one doctor said to the other, "He's a lying son of a whatever, you know." And he says, "Just cut them out anyway." So that's what happened. Got my appendix out for nothing. There was nothing wrong with him. But they gave me a leave too. And I went back up to Philadelphia. And by this time I got married for the first time. Her name was Bernice. When I got married to her, her name was Bernice. When I'm in front of this chaplain to get married, he says, "Do you take this woman, Aline Marie Pollock, for your wife?" I'm saying, "What the hell is you, Aline Marie Pollock?" I didn't even know her. And then tattooed my arm as Bernice. And that was my first wife. Got down there. I went back down to Fort Bragg, and I finished up my term in the army. And I hit sight all over America before I'd paid for to come on the train or a bus or anything. And coming through Virginia, I'll never forget it. I hit sight through here 100 times or more. Old Route 301 and Route 1. 301 and Route 1, I was. And every time we got to Virginia, either the guy that was driving the car, or the truck, or whatever, got fined or arrested or something. And then we're going, anyway. I got up back home anyway, and moved in with this young lady, and it was magic for a little while, you know. Drink never played any part in my... I used to go for a drink occasionally in the army. I'd go down and sit in the bar in Fayetteville. The trainer would come down and get me and say, come on, we're boxing, we're fighting tonight. And tomorrow we're going to Kentucky to fight, and we're going here and we're going there. And that was all right. I enjoyed that drink now and occasionally. I get into a little scrape now and then. But when back up the road to Philadelphia after I get discharged for the army, and I started work as a painter and decorator. My brother had come down to Canada, from Canada at a particular time, and was working away at the painting, and we're painting all the gas stations from Philadelphia all the way down to Florida, Texaco gas stations, and there were a big squad of us, you know. And then I went back up to Philadelphia, and the guy put me in charge of, to paint the Christ Church, the oldest church in Pennsylvania, I think it is, in the middle of Philadelphia, 2nd Street and Market Street. And I was up in the tower painting away, and Betsy Ross House had more paint on it than the steeple did, because I was at the drink by this time. And the boss came down and says, we've got a big layoff this week, Harry. I says, I'll give you the name. He says, oh, you, he says, you're at the top of the list. So that was me getting the bag. So I started playing soccer for a while. And I met a guy from Glasgow, a guy called Chick Brady. Beautiful boxer, never smoked, never drank in his life. And Chick says that he was talking to my brother, and Billy told him I was a pretty good at the boxing. Chick asked me if I'd like to turn pro. I said, yeah, that's a good idea, you know. And for about 3 months, everything was going good. Then I got into the fight of the month, and the fight of the week. I was fighting maybe twice a week or twice a month on the television. Everything was going good. Money all over the place, you know. The more money I got, the more fame I wanted, you know. First wife left, second wife left, third wife left. And then I got an accident, and I got my throat cut, my jaw broken in 3 places, stabbed in the back, a year after 2. This was all in one night. And about 6 weeks later, you know, I got out of hospital, and they were taking out all my the wires and everything from my jaw, and met this guy Canfield. He was up back in Philadelphia and up the Jewish neighborhood. And I met this friend of mine. He was a ventriloquist. Canfield Smith was his name. And a wee dummy called Snotgrass. And he was a founder member of the Goodwill industry up there. And Canfield and his wife came from Scotland many, many years ago before I got there. He had a big bar and grill. And he says, Harry, could you do me a favour? This guy got me out of jails and paid my fines, and him and his wife were really good to me. I says, far as it can feel, he says, I'm going to do the Ed Sullivan Show for charity. Would you mind going up and watch my bar and grill for me? I says, oh, I'd love to, you know. Get some, do him a favour because I owe them everything. I went up there anyway and all dickied up behind the bar, and there were 3 other guys working in there. I'm just watching them. If there's any thieving going on, I'm going to be doing it, you know. Simple as that. And can't feel it in the way to do the show anyway. Ed Sullivan show. This big blonde came in, Joni. Beautiful looking girl. And she was in the diner down the road, and her and I were in talking terms like, morning y'all, have a nice day y'all, and all this nonsense. And she looked a wee bit perturbed sitting behind the cash register. And I went over to perturb her a little bit more. And she decided I was what she wanted. And I decided she was what I wanted. And Canfield come back for the show anyway at 1-2 o'clock in the morning. And he says, "How's things?" I says, "It was good, good night, you know. I didn't have anything to drink that night." And Joanie's sitting there and she wanted me to take her home. And I says, "Oh, okay, you know." So I went out for a wee drink afterwards. And I came 3 days later, Tuesday or Wednesday. And the room was half the size of this. And the sun shining in the windows, like one of these lights shining down, you know. And this beautiful blonde just comes walking out of nowhere. Like a storybook, you know. And now I'm looking at her, she's a black negligee on. And I'm looking at her, oh my God. What have I done this time, you know? She is a picture, you know, the sun shining right through that negligee. I can still see her yet. And I looked out the other side of the bed and there were 6 kids, 2 dogs, a cat and a raccoon sitting there. And I just kind of looked up and I looked back and she introduced the tribe. At the end of the statement she says, "This is your new daddy." I get married in a blackout. Upstate Pennsylvania, Camelback. And that was how my drinking was going at that particular time, you know. Like I says, that was my 4th wife. And things were just getting worse and worse, you know. And I got a phone call from my brother, he was out in Calgary at the time. He says, "You've got to go home, my dad's dying, 1970. And I says, "Oh my God, you know, I don't have a penny. I don't have a nickel." I went and seen that girl, Joanie, for... Occasionally I'd stay in her house. Occasionally I was living rough. She got me alone and got me I lost my passport. She got me a new passport. She got me a tax clearance so I wouldn't have got out of the country. And a lot, you know. And I went home to bury my dad anyway. I go home to Scotland and my brother and I went out for a drink after the funeral. There was a young lady come over and she says, "Thanks very much for all these lovely letters you sent me." And I said, "Who? Hey, you know." And brother says, "That's your childhood sweetheart, Mary." And I'm saying, "My God, you know." She came back over and I took her out that night for a dinner. And the next night I took her out again. And she was telling me she's got 3 kids. And she was looking for a divorce. I says, "I'm your man. I'll get you a divorce. I'm good at that, you know." And she fell for it, the hook, line, and sinker. I says, "I'll just go back to America and settle up all my estate." I hadn't a pot to cure it in. And she fell for it anyway. And I come back to America and I was finishing a paint job up in Philadelphia with a little Jewish lady. She owed me about $450. She gave me the money and I went next door and bought a one-way ticket home to Scotland. And I left with all my worldly possessions. 2 pillowcases full of rubbish. A couple of shirts, a couple of suit jackets, pants, and a couple of pair of shoes. I had hundreds and hundreds of trophies. Don't know where they went to. Money, I don't know where it went to. My houses, I don't know where they went to. I know where they are. They're still working up there, some of them, you know. But that's how my life was when I took drink, you know. I went home to Scotland. And I thought, well, this is going to be a new start for a chance, you know. My eldest brother says, "What the hell are you doing back here?" I says, "I don't know." I says, "I need a break." That was in 1970. A guy, an old friend of mine, is a bricklayer. He traded, won some money or got something. He bought a big bar and grill up at the top of Loch Lomond. And he hired me as a bar manager. And that was great for at least 4 or 5 months. Stayed dry. Everything was going good. Mary and I got married. We had a wee girl. Everything was going good. and things to turn for the worse, you know. I got moved out of that place into another place near home, and I hijacked the bar one night. Wouldn't let the cops in, wouldn't let the owners in or nothing. Me and a couple of ladies of the night were having a good time, so nobody was getting in to spoil it. I forgot the girls needed money, so they just raided the tills while I went to the bathroom. And I get the bag, almost get to jail for that job too. And things happened beyond my wildest dreams. In and out, it wasn't jail, it was little prisons, you know, or things like that happened to me, you know. I met this guy called Johnny McIntyre. He's out in California at the moment. Johnny's sober, about 37 years or so. Took me my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first meeting I went to in Dumbarton, in Scotland, there were guys like I'm doing now, sharing their experience, standing hope. And I couldn't imagine me when he said, your life's unmanageable. And I said, how the hell could my life be unmanageable? Jumped out of aeroplanes, a millionaire, five wives, you name it, and I've had it. Couldn't believe it, you know. I went in there pretty happy that night, and I came out, I was an alcoholic, I was off my head, and owed everybody money. The worst move I ever made. So, 3 months down the line, you know, I stopped going to Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife threw me out. I was on the streets, I was up and down to London, up and down to Aberdeen, Dundee, all the different places where the Royal Rigs were working all over the place. And I just couldn't get it, you know. The second time around came, I got back to the fellowship, March the 3rd, 1977. And for 16 years, I didn't understand this program. And all I did was go to meetings, listen to speakers. If I was asked to speak, I'd go anywhere to speak. And 9 times out of 10, I'd tell your story because my story wasn't good enough. And it was going on and on and on like that, you know. I was working in a little holiday resort in Scotland, and Balloch, Linda stayed there when she was over visiting with Ross. And I'm working up there, and a young lady came to the window where the office was, and she knocked on the window, and I heard this voice. And I says, oh my God, maybe one of my daughters or somebody's caught up with me. It was a Yank, you know, an American girl. She says, excuse me, sir, but could you help me? I says, if I can, I'll help you. I was sober 16 years at this time, I believe. 15 or 16 years. And this little girl's name was Annette. She says, I'm looking for the hostel. I says, oh, it's only about a mile and a half up the road. It's up the Lush Road, I said. I says, there's a bus due any minute. And the bus is gone. I says, well, jump into my car and I'll take you up. She had a couple of suitcases. Take her up to the hostel in Loch Lomond. And on the way up the Lush Road, I happened to mention that a higher power was looking after her that day. And she says, oh my God, your friend of Bill W's? I says, yes. So I took her all over Scotland. Couldn't get her out of graveyards. Films got me to jail a couple of times, throwing her over fences through these old graveyards. She loved them. Taking photographs and writing down all them names and all this nonsense, you know. And she came back here anyway, to Richmond, and she called me up and thanked me for all the help. She called us the Scottish Mafia, Alcoholics Anonymous Mafias. Because my friend Mick and I and all the gang I used to run around with, you know, treated her royally, you know, and she was a darling. And she called me anyway, and then she sent me a letter saying she'd like me to go over and visit. And she told me where she lived, Richmond, Virginia. I said, Virginia, it's a hellhole of the world. I said, you never... you're Joel. She says, no, it's nice. It's not, you know. So I decided, well, I'll go over anyway. It's a lovely girl. So I packed my bag and out we come. The first time was 17 years ago. And she picked me up, her and her boyfriend, a guy called Miles, picked me up at Baltimore and brought me down. On the way down, she says, I don't have room. I've only got a small house, a small apartment. She says, but my friend Ross and Linda are going to look after you while you're here. And that's when I was introduced to Ross and Linda, 17 years ago. And what a life that's been. This is where I learned about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My friend Ross, every year, is saying, I'm going up to Baltimore for a weekend. It's a retreat. That says, no way. I don't go with these people that walk on water. No. And I said a few other fancy things, you know, you're joking. You've got to be joking, Ross, you know. But I went. I went up to the retreat in Baltimore. And I'm sitting out in the windowsill, big cigarette, put it that way. Must have been a pal mile or something. And this wee monk's walking around the building, praying. And he's passing by my window. I wonder if I nipped that cigarette would hit him in that wee bald spot, you know. And I jumped back in the window and says, you bastard, you're still sick. Yeah. The next night, that's when the miracle happened. I told all them years ago, 33 years ago I got told, don't give up before the miracle happens, Harry. Whatever you do. And that's exactly what happened. The next night, Tom Flynn asked me to speak. And he said, you only have to speak for 15 minutes or something, Harry. And Ross came over and he picked me up. He says, you know, Harry, I've spoke a couple of times in Brixton Forum. He says, you know, Harry, he says, you don't have to curse while you're sharing. And I looked at him and said, what? I says, it'll take 10 minutes to share my experience in the home if I don't start praying, you know. He said, try it. So I spoke, it was supposed to be 15 minutes, I spoke for 45 minutes. And he came over and he grabbed me and he gave me a big hug. And he says, that was beautiful, and you never cursed once. And that, you can imagine what I was thinking to myself. Either he's lying or I'm going off my rocker. 2 weeks later, I get that speak in the meeting I was at this morning in the Union Hall in Richmond. 9:30 meeting, Serenity. And I said to Ross, well, Ross says, I was there last week. I says, there's 600 people there, at least 500 anyway. He says, no, it's the 4th of July, Harry. They'll all be going to the mountain or down the sea, down to the ocean. I said, all right, then, you know. So in there, and the buses were kept coming in from all over the place, bringing all these sick people up, you know. And I'm sitting up on the stage with Ross, and he'd all these pigeons in, redoing all the readings, you know. And that was some morning, believe me. And I got up and I did the same thing again. Without swearing. And I looked down at the front row and there was a wee Scotch guy sitting there. As wee guy and I never got on. Never. I was getting ready to shout at him. And at that time they were making tapes of the meeting. And at the end of the meeting, this wee guy, John, they made the tapes at the time. This Mick comes up and they're buying a tape. I says, I don't got your tape, Mick. He says, no, don't you touch that tape, he says. I'm going to take it home and make some money out of this. How the hell you make money out of tape of me? He said, I'm going to bet nobody knows who's speaking on that tape. This is people over Scotland making English. He says, you never cursed once in that tape. So they won't know who you are. And that was the beginning of my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous after 16 years. Now give up before the miracle happens. Since then, the people I sponsor today, I respect them, they respect me. Sometimes I revert back to what I used to be very quickly when I think people are trying to take advantage of me. But the biggest majority of times when I have to revert back to the old me, the guy would walk in here and see somebody try to 13 step a woman, that guy would just went up without words and knock him in his ass and tell the young lady, stay away from clowns like that. They give the Alcoholics Anonymous a bad name. But today I don't have to do these things. 9 times out of 10 when I go to prisons, life or jails and things like that, my language changes a wee bit. I don't want them people to what they're thinking about me, you know. When I go to young offenders, I try to tell them they don't have to be like me to be a man. And the same, I go to women's prisons all the time too. And I go to Almon where Linda goes. And that's one of the hardest things I ever do. Speak in front of women. And men. They're an all-knowing. And I know exactly some of them faces when they look at you. And they've had... And one of them... Just a couple of months ago, when I was talking about my wives and things like that, you dirty wee bastard, you know. Try to call under the table. That's how sometimes when I'm looking out... I go up to Al's now and again, you know. He's got a school for these wayward kids or whatever they are. And when I speak up there, you know, I'm looking out and they're looking straight back at me, you know, and I'm saying, that's never going to happen to me, you know. And I'm saying, yes, it will. I know what you think. That's how my story goes. And Alcoholics Anonymous didn't give me life back, it gave me a new life. It's given me everything I have today. I come over here at least twice a year sometimes. And I was only over here once last year. And I'm going to try and make it back this year. Because you are the people that gave me what I've got today. I've got a friend. He had a very... He came in here, he had a stutter. He called it a stutter. You know, that's how he spoke. He says, you better believe it's getting better, Harry. He says, I went to a meeting last week and I found out I don't have a stutter. He says, I've got a impediment of speech. So things are getting better for Joe, you know. And he says he believes in the three P's. The people, the program, and the power behind it. That's why this morning I got up. I take my favourite step, you know, step 11. Start through prayer and meditation, my, improve my conscious contact with God, as I understand, praying only for His knowledge, my will for me. I do that on a daily basis, maybe 10 times a day. And I thank Him every time I turn a corner, not getting hit with a bus or hit with some of my bottle or something, because that's how my life always was. Looking for the unexpected to happen. Talking to my daughter on the phone last night, and my grandson's graduating from high school this year, and he was away getting measured for his kilt. And, I promised that when I go home, I'll buy him a ski and do. Ski and do's a knife to put down the stock, and a purse to put in front. and a few other things that I'm going to get him for you. And he loves that. His papa. Don't send me any money. He says, I want a tattoo when you come home. Everybody wants tattoos. I said, I'll give you one of mine. I'll give you like one of my first wives, Bernice. With even her name. But today, if I can do anything for anybody, and Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll gladly do it. I've got three, what do you call them, hooks, different things for you to take. My pal, John Bruce, he's got two boats up in Loch Lomond, and him and I go out on a Wednesday, go fishing. There's another loch way up north, we call it Loch Hall. And I was out there for 12 hours one day, we got to John, and never caught a thing. But what a day I had. See them big eagles coming down from the mountains. And they're cute. They didn't go into the loch. They went into the fish farm. Guys feeding the fish in the fish farm. Thinking they're the loch. Just and I said to John, why don't we go? If my life gets any better, it'll be far too good. I thank Billy for inviting me down here. Because this is the life's blood in Alcoholics Anonymous. I welcomed everybody here today. No matter who you are or what you are, who you think you are. You know, I believe in God today, and that's not me. I'm glad to be here and grateful to be sober. Thanks for having me. Thank you.